Hi, everyone. Drew Pruitt here, host of the Broken Ring Podcast. Today, we're talking about IBS with Dr. Sanaya Rafacha. She's here to talk about the leading diagnosis by gastrointestinal doctors, and that's irritable bowel syndrome. It's estimated that 10 to 15% of the population in the United States, and now the rest of the world is heading in that direction too, has IBS, but only 50% of them have been diagnosed. If you have bloating, discomfort in your stomach, if you have constipation regularly, or a whole host of other GI issues, you could be on track to develop irritable bowel syndrome, or you might have it right now. What can you do about it, and what is the functional medicine approach to treating IBS? Crazy thing, IBS for years was thought to be something that was just in the patient's head. And then doctors realize it's not just in their head, something is actually going on. But conventional medicine, which is doing its best, I really do believe that, is coming short when it comes to solutions to help patients feel better today. That's why we have Dr. Sanaya on. We're excited for this podcast. Stay tuned. Hi, everyone. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by my new venture and our newest protein powder, the Pegan Shake. One of the best ways to boost your brain power is with the best nutrition. This is why Dr. Mark Hyman and I teamed up to create the perfect shake to start your morning off right and set your brain and body up for vitality and success. The shake is called the Pegan Shake, and it features a combination of grass-fed collagen, organic pumpkin, and organic pea protein powder with healthy fats from MCT oil and avocado oil, which, by the way, are great for fat burning and fueling brain power as well. A little bonus, the Pegan Shake also features organic acacia fiber, which is great for gut motility and digestion. See, this shake was created to support healthy blood sugar and healthy energy levels. In fact, one of the most common reasons for mood imbalances and brain challenges come from unbalanced blood sugar. Have you ever felt anxious, tired, and wired, and then ate something and felt better? Well, when your blood sugar goes through major fluctuations throughout the day, you literally can feel crazy. I know so many people can relate. So the Pegan Shake supports your blood sugar by feeding your body the right information from this perfect combination of macronutrients. I've been using the Pegan Shake for months, and I feel full, satisfied, satiated, focused, and most importantly, I avoid those energy slumps that come in the late afternoon too. I think you're gonna love this shake. Dr. Hyman and I teamed up to make it because we literally couldn't find a shake mix that we loved. So we decided to create it ourselves. Check it out at getpharmacy.com/pegan shake. You can find the link in the show notes. That's getpharmacy, pharmacy with an F, pharmacy.com/pegan shake. Now on to today's episode. Hi, everyone. Drew Pruitt here. Today, we're talking about irritable bowel syndrome, IBS. You heard some of the stats in the intro of how many people it impacts, and it does seem to be growing. Irritable bowel syndrome, what is it? It's a common disorder that affects the large intestines, and it's a disease or disorder rather, not disease, it's a disorder that is diagnosed through exclusion. So that means that the symptoms that people could be experiencing is wide ranging. You could be having cramping, abdominal pain, bloating, gas, diarrhea, constipation, a whole host of different things that could be going on. And if a doctor suspects that you have chronic cramping, chronic diarrhea, chronic bloating that's there, and if you have to rush to the bathroom, or you feel like you actually have chronic constipation, you can't go to the bathroom. For some people, it's over the course of many days that they actually might feel constipated. You know, my business partner, Dr. Hyman, he would often say that we live in a constipation nation. And if that is you, you might end up going to the doctor. And through a process of what's recommended to them, they'll go through a whole list to see if they can find out what's going on. And if they notice that it's not anything that they can address right away, you may be referred over to a gastroenterologist, or you may leave with the diagnosis of irritable bowel syndrome, a syndrome that has no cure and just has to be managed for your entire life. Could be certain drugs that you're put on and maybe some light level recommendations in terms of diet. But the question is there more that we can dig into? And what does functional medicine say about getting to the root of this syndrome? And functional medicine has a lot to say about this topic. They look at the root factors that all contribute to these symptoms that somebody might experiencing. They're going to look at your gut bacteria. They're going to be looking at your food sensitivities that are there. And are you consuming certain foods that are causing more constipation, more disruption? Are you missing out on fiber? You know, you go to your doctor sometimes, and I remember my grandmother going to her doctor at the time and saying that she was experiencing some constipation and getting recommendations for Metamucil and other things like that, which can be supportive. But what about the classic example of just how much vegetable fiber and phytonutrients, which are so important for our gut bacteria? What about that? You know, most doctors aren't talking about that, again, because they just weren't trained in it. It's not a conspiracy. They just don't know. So that's why we brought on Dr. Sanaya Rafatcha. A little bit about her. She's really an incredible person. I'll tell you background story. I had a podcast listener that was looking for a functional medicine doctor in Denver that had a very specific condition. And I was asking around, and one of the people that I had asked said, check out Dr. Sanaya. And she wrote this article exactly on this condition and kind of broke it down a little bit. And I thought, this is fantastic. So I sent it over to the listener. I said, listen, never worked with this doctor before, hadn't had direct experience, but she seems really knowledgeable and seems like she has the heart of a teacher because she's always educating and writing blog posts on these different things. Check her out. So that listener ended up working with Dr. Sanaya as a patient and has been having a great experience so far. So a little bit about our guests today. Dr. Sanaya is a board certified family medicine physician and medical director and co-founder of Prime Health in Denver, Colorado. Prime Health is a team of medical providers and health coaches that provides full spectrum functional medicine and primary care with an emphasis in treatment and reversal of hypothyroidism and irritable bowel syndrome. She graduated at the top of her class from the University of Michigan with a BSE in biomedical engineering, received her medical degree from the University of Miami, and did her residency and training at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, Florida. Prior to starting Prime Health, which by the way, she works with her husband in it, super awesome dude, she was a physician at Parsley Health. Great company. I'm an investor, happy to say that, in New York City, a technology forward functional medicine practice where she was integral to its rapid growth. Dr. Sanaya worked and received expert mentorship at the renowned Mount Sinai Beth Israel Center for Health and Healing. Dr. Frank Lipman's 1111 Wellness Center in New York City, great place. Also know Frank, awesome guy. And Dr. Robert Roundtree's Boulder Well Care. We deep dive into irritable bowel syndrome with Dr. Sanaya, and she's got some very practical tips to help us understand what we can do today to improve our health if we have this disorder. And more importantly, for those that don't, how you can discover if you're in that gray area. And I start off the podcast by telling Dr. Sanaya about a friend of mine who was exactly in this gray area. There's this gray area where maybe you're lightly constipated. Maybe you lightly have intestinal pain, or you lightly have issues with diarrhea, but it's starting to show up more frequently. And you go for your annual physical, but then your doctor tells you, well, there's nothing wrong with you. I can't see anything. And this is what happened to my friend. So I tell Dr. Sanaya about this story and get her thoughts on this friend of mine and what they went through and how so many people are in that same boat. So let's jump into the podcast and listen in with me, starting with this story about my friend. So in conventional medicine, you know, a lot of people go for, you know, I had a friend who was diagnosed with IBS last year. And prior to his diagnosis, he had been going for his yearly physical. He'd go for his yearly physical, he'd go to the doctor, and he'd say, like, I feel kind of constipated, I feel bloated, I don't feel like my stools are really super healthy. And the doctor would say, okay, great, you know, try to do more fiber, take a little bit of this, but, you know, essentially, there's nothing that bad going on with you right now. And he was under the age of 40, where they typically would be recommending like a colonoscopy, you know, more regularly. So it's like basically the doctor saying like, look, all your labs are coming back normal. You look like you're in good health. Just try a couple of these basic things and try to eat a little bit more fiber, primarily from grains is, you know, what they're recommending. Then finally it got really bad and they noticed a little bit of blood in his stool. And the doctor said, okay, let's refer you over to a gastroenterologist. And he went to that gastroenterologist and through basically just questionnaire, you know, meeting with them, talking to him about his diet, looking over the symptoms that he was experiencing, he was like, look, you have IBS, right? And that goes back to your larger point that it's something where you have to rule out a lot of stuff to actually see, is it something else that is causing what this patient is going through? But right. The point that I'm making is that because in traditional conventional medicine, he wasn't bad enough for a diagnosis, they were waiting for things to get worse before they could really tell him anything. So that's that gray area. And I think a lot of our listeners here who are listening find themselves in that gray area. They go to the doctor, they don't feel good, their digestive tract isn't great, they feel more bloated after a meal, they don't feel like their bowel movements are always fantastic, they get a little bit of constipation, but they don't have a diagnosis yet on how, you know, on how to move forward. Talk to us about some of the testing. You know, most important is that, you know, you sitting with the patient and good functional medicine doctors spending time to really go through their history, because you can't learn everything from a test, right? You need to really look at somebody's actual life history, life events that are there. But once you get into testing, let's talk about the specific test and let's break them down a little bit. So say you start to suspect that a patient might have IBS or gastrointestinal things going on. What's one of the first tests that you might consider bringing in to look at their overall health to give you an indication of where they stand?
Yeah. So yeah, I really like that story. It really illustrates perfectly, you know, how this all kind of works, which is unfortunate, you know, with the way that medicine is going right now, how we tend to like wait until the last minute, until something serious presents, and then act reactively instead of proactively, you know, trying to prevent things from happening. So thanks for sharing that. And yeah, I mean, on testing, the first and foremost, you know, background of like even starting to test is like recognition that there's something else going on. Because I think that's also what's so lacking in the way that we're approaching things from a conventional medicine standpoint is that, you know, some people may not be taught, you know, they might not be taught about SIBO. Also in conventional approaches, you know, candida and like yeast overgrowth in the gut, that's not recognized as being a diagnosis quite yet. Even though we can find it on stool tests. And the other thing is, you know, parasites are oftentimes found in IBS patients, and we do testing, you know, stool testing to look at that. And they do come up on the functional, more specific, you know, parasite tests that we order. But the testing that you get from a conventional lab, unfortunately, it tends to miss a lot of things. And the reason is because they're only doing an ova and parasite culture. They're not necessarily, or they're looking at under a microscope and looking for the worms. And if they're not there, then it's negative. Whereas we use a lot of functional tests like Genova or GI Map, or even actually an awesome microbiologist out here in Colorado has a company called Pear Wellness Research. And he actually does do microscopic analysis, but way more in depth. But the Genova and the GI Map, they're actually doing a PCR analysis. So that means they're actually looking for DNA of these parasites. So looking for DNA and then looking under a microscope, you know, you could get very different results. And a lot of times I will get different results for those two different tests on one stool sample. So doing both of those, though, increases the chances of us actually coming up with a positive result. And then, of course, we're looking for yeast, which is not necessarily something that they're going to do, you know, at a conventional lab. So doing stool analysis is fantastic. You can also get a lot more information out of that. You can see how many, you know, if this person is making digestive enzymes in normal quantity. You can see if they're making eosinophilic protein X, which is actually a marker for inflammation, but allergy type inflammation. And that's not a standard test either. So, you know, that can give us a little more information, like maybe this person does have some serious food allergies, or maybe they have histamine intolerance. You know, that would be the direction that we might go if that's elevated. So yeah, there's a lot of amazing tests that we can get from functional stool analysis that we can't get in a conventional stool analysis. So even if your gastroenterologist has done a stool test and you're saying, oh, well, my stool was normal, you know, but not necessarily. If you go to a functional doctor and do these more functional specific stool tests, you actually might come up with some information that could be really helpful.
So before we get into a couple questions that I have on nutritional testing, because obviously that's always a hot topic for people. They want to know, am I eating something that's making me worse off? Or am I missing something that's not having my digestion be as healthy as it could? Talk about the limitations of testing. You know, one thing I try to do in this podcast is when I interview good, you know, great doctors like yourself, is I also try to help the audience set expectations around testing. So, you know, mm-hmm. what can we get big picture from testing, and what are also some of the limitations with testing that people should be aware of, even when it comes to functional medicine?
Yeah, there's always limitations to testing, and no test is ever going to be 100%. So unfortunately, that's the case. But I do still think that the validity of stool testing and SIBO testing is fantastic. However, with breath testing for SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, we're basically testing for two different gases, methane and hydrogen. And generally speaking, you know, if you have a methane positive test, then you're producing, you know, that gas, some bacteria are in your small intestine producing that gas, tends to lead toward more constipation symptoms. And there is a specific treatment for that with antibiotics or potentially herbals and some other things, maybe promotility agents. And then hydrogen gas, you know, it's usually associated with more like loose stool or diarrhea type symptoms. And the treatment could be a little bit, you know, different. Like maybe we'll just use Ifaxin or Ifaximin as opposed to combining it with neomycin for the methane. So something that comes up sometimes with the SIBO testing is that you'll get a negative test, but the patient will have tons of symptoms. And so something that has been gaining a lot more publicity now is that you could actually have a hydrogen sulfide gas. And that's a gas that's not being tested for right now at all in clinical setting. They are doing a lot of research on it in Dr. Pimentel's lab. And the information's coming out about that. I just talked to Gary Stapleton yesterday from Aerodiagnostics, and that's the company that we use most for SIBO testing. It's really fantastic. He says that he's done like more than 50,000 tests, so he has a lot of data. And he says that about 1-2% of people might actually have hydrogen sulfide gas, even though it tests negative, which is a really good nuance to know. And generally speaking, it's going to be accompanied with things like reflux symptoms, you know, gastrointestinal reflux and acid reflux, or, you know, a lot of times loose stool, because that type of gas kind of loosens up your smooth muscle in the GI tract. So when you have looser muscles in the lower esophageal sphincter, you can get reflux symptoms. So that's not even IBS, that's, you know, GERD or reflux, and that can also be due to SIBO, for instance.
So if I could interject, just to add a little bit of context, sure. To all the, you know, our audience loves to get in the weeds, so I appreciate the information. You know, they want to know, they're smart, they're sophisticated. Let's give a little context for those that aren't as familiar. You know, we spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about how bacteria, you know, is not the enemy and how it is good. So when people hear SIBO, right, small intestinal bacteria overgrowth, they're a little bit confused. They're like, well, I thought bacteria was good. What's the real problem with having bacteria in the small intestines, or the wrong type of bacteria? If you could share that with our audience.
Yes, absolutely. So yes, SIBO is quite, you know, obviously, it's a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So it's an overgrowth in a specific place in your gut. small intestine, you're only supposed to have about 10 to 20,000 or so bacteria in that part of your gut. And the large intestine harbors like trillions of bacteria. So that's a really big difference in terms of the quantity of bacteria that are supposed to be there. And there's particular types of bacteria, I think lactobacillus, you know, can be overgrown, and SIBO and other ones as well, methanogens if you're making methane. And so the way that that happens, there's a lot of actually proposed reasons for how this occurs, and actually medication can induce it in a lot of ways. It can induce it because if you're taking something like a proton pump inhibitor, something like Nexium, Protonix, those types of drugs that are prescription or over the counter, they can actually create this situation where your acid in your stomach is no longer being produced in sufficient quantity. And so that acid is no longer killing the bacteria as it should, as it moves from the stomach into the small intestine. So if you have this like higher pH where the bacteria are surviving more in the small intestine, that can lead to an overgrowth. So that's a really important thing to realize. Like people, a lot of people are put on these medications, proton pump inhibitors, for a very long time. And actually on the insert, it'll say this should not be used for more than 3 months. Mm. And I mean, I've had patients come to me and they're like, yeah, I've been on it for like 10 years, you know? And it's like, okay, well, no wonder you have all these symptoms now. And maybe you have nutrition deficiencies now, and you know, all these different things going on. So yeah, that's a really tough situation.
And to add to that on the clarification, what is really the function of the small intestines, right? We just had an episode that we did on colon rectal cancer come out this week that you and I are recording, and Dr. Liz Boehm went pretty deep into the large intestines and talking about that and the colon and what its purpose is. What's the purpose of the small intestine, and why does it have so much less bacteria? And when it gets off, how is it that that can be maybe potentially linked to IBS?
Yeah, well, the small intestine is definitely going to be absorbing different nutrients. So folate, which is vitamin B9, which is so essential, especially around like pregnancy, you know, it's always in a prenatal vitamin. That's where vitamin B12 gets absorbed, another essential nutrient. You know, you could get neurological symptoms if you're deficient in that, as well as iron, you know, so iron and all of these are essential nutrients, and it's absorbing a lot of this stuff. So if there's an overgrowth in your small intestine, you're definitely not going to be absorbing nutrients in correct quantity, you know, as you should be. And it's also where a lot of things get digested, like meat will get digested for the most part in your small intestine. You know, after the acid does its work, it then, you know, the pancreatic enzymes get shot out into your small intestine as well. So, and bile acids. So a lot of things are getting broken down into smaller pieces so that they can be absorbed better. So that is really, really essential to occur, you know, for normal digestion to happen. And it's interesting, like comparing the large and the small intestine. It's something that I read about recently in Dr. Paul Saladino's book, The Carnivore Code, that came out this year. It's really fascinating what he's put together there. And his argument, of course, is that we're meant to be eating potentially completely only meat, but definitely more meat than vegetables, which is like a total paradigm shift for many of us, maybe most of us. So he talks about how, you know, in humans and, you know, later on in our evolution, you know, we've developed these gastrointestinal tracts that have much more surface area in the small intestine than in the large intestine compared to like apes and, you know, lower primates, for instance, because they're sitting there all day chewing on vegetables and they need that time, you know, in the large intestine ruminating and kind of like absorbing and breaking down and, you know, having all this bacteria to like munch on the plant matter so that it creates short chain fatty acids. And those are actually what they use for energy, short chain fatty acids, which is actually, you know, fatty acid. It's not actually a direct energy source from the plant. It's actually made by the bacteria that digest the plant matter. So it's really fascinating. And so he's basically saying that, you know, we have these larger small intestines as opposed to large intestine, because we're supposed to be getting our nutrient density like directly from the meat and absorbing it through the small intestine tract. So that's a really fascinating, just like little comparison and, there.
And if I could jump in, I mean, it's worth talking about right now because, you know, for those who are not familiar with him, he's the carnivore MD. I haven't read the book, but I've listened to a couple podcasts that he's done with some friends of mine, Max Lugavere and Dr. Gundry. And, you know, smart guy, putting a really strong argument together. And this is why, if anybody who's listening has heard about the carnivore diet for people who are suffering with really severe autoimmune or gastrointestinal things, you know, I'd love your take. It does seem to be that some people are benefiting from going on that diet, at least initially. The question is whether or not maybe there's long-term, right? And I'm sure carnivore MT Paul has his own thoughts about it. That's still up for debate, at least with most of the functional medicine doctors that I talk to. But in that case, for those people who have heard of the carnivore diet, how do you think, what are your personal views on it? How do you think that it could be maybe benefiting some people who have severe IBS? And what are your thoughts on it for the long term?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so fascinating. I'm definitely trying to educate myself more about it because there are so many people coming out and saying, wow, like this really worked for me. And like you said, for autoimmunity, you know, that was his thing. It was severe eczema in his case, to the point of needing IV steroids. And literally yesterday, I mean, this is top of mind to me because yesterday a patient of mine from New York City a few years ago reached out to me over email saying, hey, like I've done this for a few months now. And after 2 months of doing the carnivore diet, he basically cured himself of psoriasis, like no more skin issues, no more joint issues. And also his IBS symptoms went away. So, I mean, I think that there's definitely room for this to be explored. By reading, you know, a portion of the book, I haven't gone through the whole thing, but he really goes into how you can actually get all of the nutrition that you need from meat because, you know, people say, talk about scurvy, like what about vitamin C? You know, that's like one argument that's made very often. But it turns out there is enough vitamin C in meat, especially if you're eating organ meat. And I think that's also the main difference that we're thinking like, oh, so we're just going to be eating flesh because that's the only thing that I eat right now, you know, but he's talking about eating nose to tail. Like he's talking about eating liver and, you know, potentially
the whole animal.
All these other, these organs that we're really not interested in eating, most of us, but luckily there's supplements out there too. You know, you can use supplements, you know, concurrently with this diet. I think, you know, whether it be actually organ supplements, which, you know, there's some companies that are doing that now, or you can actually take the nutritional supplements to complement. You know, if the diet's doing really good things for you, I think that it's important to be monitored by someone who's going to be checking on your nutrients, you know, regularly and just making sure, you know. And the other argument is, you know, is my cholesterol going to go through the roof? And that's other, you know, another thing that we should be monitoring, you know. We can look at that and we can see, you know, maybe if your LDL happens to be going up, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's the end of the world. Like we should look at these other things like oxidized LDL, you know, is it actually harmful LDL or, you know, what kind of LDL pattern is it? Like, is the size of your LDL large? Cause that would be okay too. You know, so it's like looking at all these different nuances and making sure that a diet that you're doing that is benefiting you in some way is not going to be detrimental in the long term.
Yeah. And, you know, to pivot, you know, we just jumped into that for a second because we're talking about basically the intestinal tract and what different parts like the small intestines is meant to digest versus the large intestines and the bacteria that's there. And ultimately the carnivore diet and people experimenting with it is a form of the most, I'm using extreme in terms of just the spectrum. It's the most extreme elimination diet that's there, right?
Right.
I mean, I guess you could say that there's also people that argue that we should only be eating fruit or not, you know, things like that. There's other types of version, but you're basically eliminating everything. Now, for the vast majority of people, you know, they're probably not going to do the carnivore diet or that's not something that they're going to be, you know, exclusively focused on. But there's something to be said about elimination in foods. So let's talk bigger picture. how is it that certain foods can be playing a role in IBS, even foods that we think of as typically healthy, which could even be sometimes plant foods that a lot of people are like, well, I thought that had a lot of fiber, but it may not be making me feel great or maybe making my IBS symptoms worse. Can you run through a few categories or examples of foods that could be triggers for people?
Oh, definitely. I mean, probably the top categories that most people think about as food sensitivities are gluten, which is, you know, from wheat mainly, but other grains as well. And then dairy, you know, those two are probably the most commonly seen as being sensitive or causing an issue in most people, like definitely from my experience. And I think as a general population as well, like, you know, for gluten, I believe it's something up to 10% of the general population is sensitive to it. So if someone comes to me with IBS type symptoms and they have not tried to eliminate gluten and dairy out of their diet yet, you know, that's definitely something that I'm going to do, you know, before I start looking into rabbit holes and, you know, doing expensive testing or whatever. You know, that's really, really important.
And could I just ask you one question about that? Sorry to interrupt. Would you say that basic food, like a basic elimination diet, is one of the most impactful, lowest cost tools in the toolbox that you have?
I would say yes.
Mm-hmm. And also, yeah. would you say that it's safe enough that people could try it at home? Obviously, we want everybody, you know, checking with their doctor on more advanced things, but is elimination diet safe enough that people could try it, you know, at home for 30 days to see what symptoms improve?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Anyone can try to eliminate gluten, dairy. I mean, the other couple things that I would just add to that list are refined sugar and heavily processed foods. You know, those are really like the top four. Like, and if you could try to eliminate those four categories from your diet for at least 2 weeks, maybe even a month if you can, that would be ideal. And if you don't get, you know, if you get 0%, you know, improvement in your symptoms, I'd be very surprised, to be honest.
So I think a lot of our audience knows about like the gluten and the dairy, you know, those definitely tend to be, and you know, more and more days like sugar. Is there another category of foods that is next that you see can still be kind of tripping people up? Especially people who have already tried to eliminate gluten and dairy and maybe haven't felt better from that alone.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in terms of food allergy, the other ones on the list tend to be eggs, corn, and soy. You know, those tend to be a problem for a lot of people. And so that's why, you know, there's something called the autoimmune paleo diet where those things are eliminated in addition to even legumes. So any type of like bean type food, as well as nuts and nightshades. Which are, you know, eggplants, peppers, potatoes. So those are all categories of different plant foods that can cause a lot of issues in a lot of people. And that's also an argument, you know, that Dr. Saladino makes is that, you know, these things are causing inflammation on a certain level in your body. And that might be the case for anyone, not just, you know, people with autoimmunity. So that's, you know, one sect. And then the other potential, you know, dietary change that could be helpful is a low FODMAP diet for SIBO and for, you know, IBS. That's actually something that's pretty conventionally put out there as being something that people can do. It's basically low fructo-oligo-di monosaccharides and polyols. That's like what it stands for, but it's basically just certain carbohydrates that are found in fruits and vegetables, plant foods, basically, that are causing, you know, excessive bloating. They tend to feed the bacteria. If you have it, if you have SIBO in your small intestine, those are the things that feed those bacteria, those dysbiotic bacteria that tend to cause IBS bloating, and gas. You know, those are the types of foods that are generally going to increase that. So having a low FODMAP diet, basically there's a whole list of things that you have to look at, you know, for instance, you can only have one half of an avocado a day, not a full one, or you can have like, you know, quarter cup of broccoli, not, you know, more than that. Mm-hmm. So it goes into very specific quantities of certain foods. And, you know, that can get very complicated. So there's actually an app out there that was made by Monash University in Australia, and it's really helpful. I think there's a couple other low FODMAP diet apps out there to help people kind of figure this out because, yeah, I mean, I hate to put people on it because it tends to cause people a little bit of stress, and that's definitely not what we want to be doing, you know, to help with IBS symptoms. But sometimes it's really helpful. There's that.
And just to add a little bit more context to that, and it's not necessary that you're going to keep this person on this diet forever. You're doing this temporarily to basically cool the flames of inflammation, while then, especially if they're under your medical supervision, you are doing a targeted repair process for the gut.
Correct. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, long term, a lot of these restrictive diets that people read about and decide to go on their own. And I want to also add in the context, you know, one of my listeners for a past episode that I did on the elimination diet, where I talked about how I figured out that I don't do really well with nightshades and how I don't do really well with dairy and gluten. They said, you know, people who have eating disorders have to be very careful because if they're going on it on their own, self-directed, they could go down this rabbit hole where they get so afraid of different types of foods when that's not the goal at all with these interventions. It's to temporarily reduce the all the craziness that's going down there in the digestive system, the inflammation, the bloating, the other stuff, so that you can initiate a repair. And if you're only doing it on your own, it's very hard to do all the functional testing and labs. Impossible, because you're not a medical doctor. You don't know how to interpret it. And so you can't actually do the repair process that lets you then be a little less restrictive. Do you see that sometimes with your patients, that they temporarily have to be on this, and then after a period of time, they can go back to enjoying some of the things that they previously had to, you know, stop for a period of time?
Yes, definitely. I think the low FODMAP diet, it's helpful for people's symptoms at times, but it's not a cure. So that's not, yeah. So I'll usually put people on what's called an anti-inflammatory diet, kind of like what we were saying, you know, eat real food, you know, try to avoid all the inflammatory stuff, like pretty simple, that kind of a thing. I'll put people on that while I treat the IBS symptoms, whether it be, you know, using antifungal herbs or medications, if the person, you know, I suspect they have yeast or we find that on a test, or, you know, putting them on antibiotic course for SIBO, or maybe a herbal course for SIBO, and like pushing things along with promotility. You know, the thing is, you know, with low FODMAP diet, you actually don't want to be on that while you're treating SIBO. And that's something that is really important to know, because while you are treating SIBO, you want to be feeding the bacteria so that they actually take up the antimicrobial that you're using. So that's definitely important to know. You know, if you're trying to treat SIBO, you know, don't be on the low FODMAP diet during that course of treatment. If it's helpful to you, you know, you can try to, you know, add some things back, you know, after an elimination diet and you feel like you got some relief. It's really important to then, you know, try adding things back that, like, the least inflammatory things first, or the least insulting things to your digestive tract first, to see, you know, maybe I can have, you know, avocado in this amount, or maybe I can have the broccoli or the apple, et cetera. And just so you can, like, try to narrow down a little bit more, you know, what are the foods that are causing the problem? And that's the best way to do it, so that you're not stuck on this really restrictive elimination diet for so long, you know, in the future. And that's probably the best way I see as figuring out food sensitivities. A lot of people do come to us asking for food sensitivity testing or food allergy testing. And that is definitely an area that I think is very limited. You know, although we have access to some food sensitivity testing, it's not always the best. You know, it doesn't really come up with things that we don't necessarily already know. Like, a lot of times things that'll come up will be things like wheat, you know, gluten, dairy. And those are the main ones that tend to come up in the ones that I've seen. So it's like, okay, if we've already tried eliminating those things, and it's improving, then the test didn't really add that much. Or it could come up with random things.
Yeah, like random stuff, like raspberries and this. And not that there might not be some measurable, you know, IgG or response that's there. It's just maybe not giving you the bigger picture. And the bigger picture could be that maybe your gut is so damaged that it's more permeable and you're just reacting to a lot of foods. But if you fixed your gut and got back the good bacteria and fixed the tight junctions, which past guests on this episode, on this podcast have talked about, then you can be a little bit more resilient. You know, food tends to get a lot of attention, but what doesn't often get as much attention is that even more powerful than food is just like the stress that we have in our lives. And what's the relationship between stress and IBS?
There's a huge relationship there. You know, I'm sure you've talked a lot about the gut-brain connection on this podcast, and for good reason, you know, because it is so important. You know, I think we don't realize, you know, how much our emotion and, you know, how we feel on a spiritual, emotional level actually plays a role in our entire body, you know, not just the gut, but our immune system even, you know, and that could be, you know, tied together because, you know, 70% of the immune system is made in the gut, but it's all connected. You know, our brain is not disconnected from our body. You know, we are connected from the neck, you know, head and body. It's completely associated with worsening symptoms, whether it be IBS or IBD, you know, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. There's been studies on that. You know, it's proven that higher stress lifestyle increases inflammation, increases gastrointestinal distress. So that is a really important area that we work on with all of our patients, you know, is kind of the emotional connection, helping people to incorporate some type of relaxation or enjoyment, you know, in their lives every single day, you know, because that's really what makes us human. And it's really something that we should not lose touch with, you know, in our kind of busy, productive lifestyle. It's just so important to be looking at, you know, the inside of, you know, what's going on, like, how are you really feeling? You know, what's the internal dialogue that you're having with yourself every day? You know, these things are all so important.
Super key. So we've covered a lot of different touch points, and I'd love to summarize an action list. You know, my hope, and I know your hope and my business partner, Dr. Hyman, is that functional medicine becomes mainstream and we invest a lot more effort and energy into dealing with these situations early on. And it's more accessible to people. You know, insurance is covering it because they realize, I mean, the stats are crazy. I read this, that 90% of the money that we pay into insurance is spent in the last 6 to 8 months of a patient's life. So what we pay in to insurance on a monthly basis, you know, $500, $600, whatever it is, family plan, a lot more expensive. Most of that money is spent on people throwing everything we can, trying to do open heart surgery right before, you know, they pass away, or throwing all the cancer treatments. And not that we shouldn't do that. It's just that if we used maybe even 5% of that money through insurance to start working with people early on, could we avoid that? And could we truly be a nation of healthcare rather than sick care? So that's the vision. We want people to have more accessibility to that. In the meantime, you know, there are innovative practices like yourself that are doing telemedicine and other things to bring the cost of functional medicine down. And my hope is that people work with doctors like yourself and other ones that we feature on the podcast. For people that are at home, that are looking to, whether they've gotten an IBS diagnosis or not, but they're looking to make, you know, changes to start immediately improving their health today, especially when it comes to either preventing or avoiding IBS. I'm going to put you on the spot. What are like 3 to 5 things that you think are a slam dunk that people can do right now at home to begin to help improve their overall gut health?
So yeah, there's definitely a lot. I think the first thing would be, you know, what are you putting in your mouth multiple times a day. So look at that, you know, first and foremost. Think about the things that we talked about today in terms of what foods are inflammatory and tend to cause problems, like the gluten, the dairy, refined sugar, processed foods, potentially trying low FODMAP, or, you know, autoimmune paleo or carnivore, you know, depending on where you're at and what's going on with you. So dietary would be number one. Number two, you know, certainly other lifestyle things, like what is the stress level going on? Like, are you in a relaxed state when you're eating, consuming food? Because, you know, only one side of our nervous systems can be active at a time, whether it be fight or flight mode, stressed out, parasympathetic nervous system, sympathetic nervous system, or the other side of that, which is I'm relaxed, I'm ready to eat something, my digestive system is primed. That's the parasympathetic nervous system. And we can try to activate that at any time through deep breathing, through thinking about things we're grateful for, you know, laughing, you know, doing things that put us into a relaxed state of consciousness. You know, think about what's going on, you know, in your daily life. Like, are you in that state when you're eating specifically? And then movement, of course, you know, that's another part of like lifestyle that is so important. You know, are you sitting at your desk for, you know, 8 straight hours, or, you know, can you get up? Can you move around, do some yoga poses, you know, wherever you are at your home office or your office, you know, trying to go for a walk after you eat. Like you said, don't lay down right away necessarily. It's not the best. So lifestyle, you know. Number three, look at the medications you're taking. You know, are you taking a proton pump inhibitor? Are you taking chronic NSAIDs, like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like Advil, Aleve, Motrin? You know, these are commonly used over the counter and they can be very helpful in acute situations, but not chronically. You know, if you're taking those types of medications all the time, that could be messing with your gut, definitely. I think those are probably three big categories that people can look at and try to make some changes with. And then there's some really interesting research on a couple supplements, like even vitamin D, you know, as simple as that. You don't really think about vitamin D and the gut that much, but there's some really good research on taking vitamin D and having adequate levels of vitamin D and how it improves IBS symptoms. And that's something we should all be taking right now anyway, because, you know, flu season's coming. Who knows what's going to happen with COVID this fall? You know, we should all be prepared, you know, prime your immune system. So vitamin D is a big one. We have a great product on our website that we sell for vitamin D. Another one is actually CBD, cannabidiol or hemp oil. You know, it's relaxing. It does activate your parasympathetic nervous system. That might be a part of it. It's also anti-inflammatory. So I think there's a lot of levels on which, you know, CBD can help with IBS symptoms too. And there's so many other things, but it really kind of depends on what you're specifically working on. But yeah, I think if people are on their own and they don't necessarily, you know, have the money to invest in working one-on-one with a functional medicine practitioner, unfortunately, it is pricey. It tends to be out of pocket, which is why, you know, we at Prime Health, we're developing group visits. And that's something that I know a lot of people in the functional medicine world are trying to do more and more right now for the accessibility reasons. And so that's something that we're launching actually this month, probably, or next month in October. And we also have online courses like our gut course that that we created this year. And I think we're going to link to that in the show notes. And, you know, we created a promo code for Broken Brain. So it's just Broken Brain, and you can take the gut course. It's 50% off with that code. And, you know, hopefully that can also give you a lot more education, you know, a lot more resources. It was done by Crystal Crowley, our amazing physician assistant that works with us. And she's amazing. You know, I really truly believe in what she created. And I think that it can help a lot of people, especially if they don't have the ability to work with a one-on-one practitioner.
Great. And yes, as you mentioned, we'll make sure we have the link to that and the code that you created for our audience. Thank you. I'll add in one more item to the supplement side, which seems to be a pretty good return on investment for a lot of people. A broad spectrum digestive enzyme. If you haven't ever tried that before, not that we want to be reliant on using enzymes long term, but it does seem to be that in our modern society, we're eating more of a variety of foods that are not always meant to be combined, you know, in human, in nature, we didn't necessarily have the ability to combine like 34 different ingredients all at the same time. And it does seem that a digestive enzyme can play a role in being helpful to break things down. So, you know, order from the trusted companies. I don't know if you have one, we'll put a link, but Pure Encapsulations, yeah. Metagenics, all the doctor's brands that are out there have some great digestive enzymes. And I know that could play a role. And I even find that a lot of people who think that they're eating really healthy and are, and even are watching their sugar, are when you actually have them measure out how many cups of vegetables they're having in a day, they're really deficient on fiber, right? What we do know, whether or not it turns out to be true that we're meant to be only eating meat through the carnivore diet, we do know that if we look at the stools and the stool fossils of our hunter-gatherer ancestors, and even modern-day hunter-gatherers, the weight of their stool is larger than the weight of our stool. I think the numbers that I pulled from an article that Dr. Hyman wrote is the average stool weight in the United States is like 4 to 6 ounces, right? Where our modern-day hunter-gatherers, our hunter-gatherer ancestors, and even modern-day hunter-gatherer societies that exist out there, they're in the 1 to 2 pounds is the weight of their stool.
God.
So they're eating a lot more fiber, and a lot of that is fiber, right? A lot of that is made up of fiber that's out there. So just think about that as you're going through the course of the day. Are you having that fiber at different meals? And the best sources of that are going to be either resistant starches or just vegetables that are there. Like, are you having vegetables for breakfast, with lunch, you know, with dinner that are out there? And how much can change when you just change the amount of fiber that you're having, even if you think that you eat really healthy?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah.
So great recommendations. This has been a fantastic podcast. I appreciate all the, you know, this is really about what is a functional medicine approach to IBS look like. And I love giving our audience this insight because the people who listen to this podcast, they're professional amateurs. You know, they maybe didn't go to medical school or maybe they don't have a degree in nutrition, but they want to dig into it and find out why is this happening, not just for themselves, but for their family too. And Dr. Sayana, I really appreciate you taking the time to take them on that journey and give them a little bit of the behind the scenes of how do you practice. For the people that are listening who would like to actually work with somebody who specializes in helping IBS patients, how can they reach out to you in the practice in terms of booking an appointment?
So the best way is through our website. It's primehealthdenver.com, and you can book a free phone consultation from the website. So that would be the best. And you can follow us on Instagram. It's primehealth_Denver. So hopefully we can connect. I'd love to. And I hope that this was really empowering for your audience, you know, showing them that an IBS diagnosis is not the end. This is more like the beginning, and there is a lot more work that we can do for you to try to figure out how to correct the issues that you're having.
Well said. We'll make sure to have all those links in the show notes and to your social media as well. That's there. Dr. Sayana, thank you so much for coming on the Broken Brain Podcast to talk about this area that needs a lot more attention. IBS is on the rise, but together we can all get a chance to do something about it. We appreciate you.
Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search there, find a provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.